choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Godspeed, John Glenn.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine.
Can I be locked? Okay, I'm out.
How does it feel for the United States to be the new record holder?
At last, huh?
When that baby lights, there's no doubt about it.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Hello and welcome. This is Michael Annis, and you're listening to episode 167 of the Space Rocket History Podcast. And now, Apollo 8, coasting uphill. Last time we left off, Apollo 8 was coasting moonward, and everything inside it, including the three astronauts, was weightless. This was the translunar coast phase of the mission. During this phase, Mission Control would stay in continuous communication with the crew. William Anders climbed out of his spacesuit and found a freedom unlike any he had ever experienced. Wearing only a pair of beta cloth coveralls over his long johns, he floated unencumbered. With a push of a fingertip against his couch, he propelled himself slowly past the instrument panel into the lower equipment bay. There, he found enough room to stretch out or to hang inverted with his feet up by the top hatch and his head pointing at the floor. In the lower equipment bay, Anders had enough space to tuck his body into a ball. A nudge against the wall sent him tumbling like an acrobat, magically suspended at the top of his arc. It would have been great fun, but for one thing, it was making him ill. Suddenly, in the midst of his aerobatics, Anders felt a wave of nausea come over him. For years, the NASA doctors had worried about the motion sickness in space, fearing that zero-G would confuse the inner ear, which gives the body its sense of up and down. But no astronaut had ever returned from orbit with anything but glowing enthusiasm for weightlessness. Borman and Lovell had spent 2 weeks in zero-G with no ill effects, but the command module had something that Gemini didn't. Room to move. The only thing Anders knew was that he needed to be still for a while, but soon he did feel better. Now I want to say a quick word about waste management on the Apollo. For urine collection, there was a hose with a condom-like fitting at one end, which led, by way of a valve, to a vent on the side of the spacecraft. To use this, you roll on the condom, open the valve, and it all goes into the void where it freezes into droplets of ice that are iridescent in the sunlight. One astronaut was asked what the most beautiful sight he saw in space. His answer was, urine dump at sunset. But the urine collector didn't work so well. For one thing, it could be painful. If you opened the valve too soon, some part of the mechanism was liable to poke you in the end of your penis, which tended to prevent you from urinating. And, at that point, as if to confirm your worst fears, the suction began to pull you in. Now, you were being jabbed and pulled at the same time, so you shut off the valve, and as the mechanism resealed itself, it caught a little piece of you in it. It only took one time like that to convince you not to let it happen again. Next time, you had a strategy. Start flowing a split second before you turn the valve. But once you begin the urination, the condom sometimes popped off, and out came a flurry of little golden droplets floating around and making your misfortune everyone's misfortune. And, of course, don't forget about the smell. The other part of the waste management system was tucked away in the storage locker. It was a supply of special plastic bags, each of which resembled a top hat, with an adhesive coating on the brim. Each bag had a kind of finger-shaped pocket built into the side of it. When the call came, you had to flypaper this thing to your behind, and then you were supposed to reach in there with your finger. After all, nothing falls without gravity. After that, you had it in the bag, so to speak. There was one last task. Break open a capsule of blue germicide, seal it up in the bag, and knead the contents to make sure they were fully mixed. At best, the whole operation was an ordeal. In the confined space of the command module, your crewmates suffered too. One of the Apollo 7 astronauts said the smell was so bad it woke him up out of a deep sleep. When Sherrall's crew came back, they wrote a memo about it. Quote, "Get naked, allow an hour, have plenty of tissues handy," end quote. Anders saw the memo and heard the stories, and before the mission, he decided he was going to do everything in his power to avoid it. The food on Apollo 8 was specially formulated to produce as little residue as possible, but Anders wasn't taking any chances. He started his own low-residue diet a few days before launch. 6 days was a long time, but he was determined he'd go all the way to the moon and back if he had to. Continuing on with the mission. At T plus 14 hours, Apollo 8 was a third of the way to the moon. But even as Borman, Lovell, and Anders sped moonward, the Earth tried to pull them back, slowing their flight. It was as if they were coasting up a hill, one that became less and less steep as it went along. About 2 days from the present, on the afternoon of December 23rd, Apollo 8 would reach the crest of that hill, the place where the Earth's gravitational influence gave way to the Moon's gravitational influence. From then on, Apollo 8 would begin falling toward its destination. For now, though, there was no sense of speed, or for that matter, any normal sense of time. To Borman's crew, time was told by the mission clock on the instrument panel. Their wristwatches were still set at Houston time, but all other vestiges of day and night had vanished. To keep the sun's heat and frigid cold of space evenly distributed on the hull, Borman had set the spacecraft rotating slowly on its axis, making one full turn in an hour. The astronauts had nicknamed this the barbecue mode. Every once in a while, as the craft turned, the men caught sight of the Earth. With each passing hour, it dwindled. They couldn't see the change as they watched, but as they turned away from it and looked again later, they noticed that it was a little smaller and more distant. At T plus 18 hours, Borman awoke after about 5 hours of fitful sleep. He didn't feel good. He told Lovell and Anders he had a headache and took a couple of aspirin. Then he just floated in his couch and watched the instrument panel. A few minutes went by, and the next thing Lovell and Anders knew, Borman was retching. Anders handed him a plastic bag, and Borman went down into the lower equipment bay and threw up. Borman was motion sick. The episode was beginning to make Anders feel a bit sick himself, when suddenly he spotted a greenish sphere about the size of a tennis ball, ascending slowly out of the equipment bay in a flurry of tiny bits and globs. The sight of it made him want to gag, but when it drifted closer, he noticed that the blob was shimmering and pulsating in three directions at once in some kind of complex fluid vibration made possible in zero gravity. At that moment, the scientist in him took over. He was about to go for a camera when suddenly the blob split in two. The twin globs headed away from each other in exactly opposite directions. One moved from where it came, and the other headed right for Jim Lovell. The blob hit him on the chest, and then, overcome by the forces of surface tension, spread out on his coveralls like a fried egg. By now, a horrible stench had rolled out of the equipment bay. Anders left Lovell to his predicament and reached for an oxygen bottle on the wall of the cabin, meant to be used in case there was a fire. Anders slapped the mask on his face and turned it on full. Meanwhile, Borman's troubles weren't over. Now he was stuck with diarrhea. What a mess! Lovell and Anders had to help chase down stray bits of vomit and feces with paper towels. Every now and then, a residual bit of vomit drifted by. Here is the clip of the astronauts recalling this incident made in 2013.
Well, the thing that we might, since you probably are, I hope you're interested in hearing a little bit about the flight too, but the launch was exciting, and then we went onto the coast. We went around once and a half around the Earth. And then over, was over Hawaii, wasn't it? We got the go for TLI, go for translunar injection. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't think we would ever get that because I knew darn well that NASA wouldn't commit us unless everything was really perfect. But over Hawaii, Mike Collins said, Apollo 8, you're go for TLI. We lit the S-4B, started out, picked up, 25,000 miles an hour?
35,000 feet a second.
35,000 feet a second, 25,000 miles an hour. And started toward the moon. Now, in order to keep the heat load equal on the spacecraft, if that was the sun, we positioned ourselves perpendicular to the sun and then just rotated all the way to the moon. I think we probably have the record for revolutions.
Yeah.
And it
barbecue
kept,
mode.
We call it the barbecue mode. About two or three. I might as well get this out of the way right now because it'll come up sooner or later.
And it came up.
I began to feel funny.
I'll tell you, it wasn't a bit funny.
You know, Jim Lovell and I had flown for 2 weeks, and I had never gotten sick. I'd never been sick in an airplane, but I really wasn't feeling too good. And so I managed to throw up all over him. And that caused great consternation back on Earth when Anders wanted to squeal on me. I wouldn't let him. So finally he dumped it on the tape and they read about it. And then
8 hours later, I covered his tail for 8 hours.
But interestingly enough, all the scientists and Dr. Van Allen was convinced that we got fried going through his ionosphere belt. The doctors were going nuts and we wanted, as if they couldn't decide whether or not they were going to abort the mission. They didn't have much to say about it, really.
Frank, I have to tell you this right now, but we were going to the moon regardless of what happened
exactly.
To you.
Exactly. That's my point. No matter what they said, we were on our way.
Right, Jim had broken out the rubber bag to put him in.
But anyway, I got over it in a big hurry, and then we did that for about 3 days. And then I'll just talk about inserting it into the lunar
before
orbit.
You go there, Frank.
Hey, we're already to the moon here, Frank. I haven't even taken off yet.
We need to...
Without getting into too much gory detail, Jim and I were up in the operational part. Frank was down in the navigation bay. And out of the navigation bay came this blob. kind of greenish, yellowish. And as a physicist, it intrigued me because it had this three-dimensional oscillation. And Jim was sitting over here, and we were both fascinated by it, you know. And I was thinking, God, I ought to get a picture of that, you know. And then it split. Wait a minute, it's my story. And it's not quite true, but it's still a good story. And the conservation momentum would say that when it split, you know, part would go one way, and the other would part. So it was kind of hitting this, and one part went this way, and the other part went right towards Jim. And I'll never forget, his eyes just came in like that, like a fried egg on his chest. You owe him one, Frank.
At T plus 1 day and 1 hour, Borman was feeling much better, blaming his illness on a 24-hour virus. Anders wanted him to reveal the incident to Mission Control, but Borman refused. Anders finally convinced his commander to put a short summary on tape. The message could be sent to Earth via a special telemetry channel. That way, no one would hear except the few managers who listened to the tape. 3 hours later, Mike Collins called Apollo 8 on a special frequency. Here's the clip.
This is Houston, all right?
Go ahead, Houston. How do you read?
Now, Roger, we're reading you loud and clear. We're on a private loop now, and we'd like to get some amplifying details on your medical problem.
Frank, this is Chuck. Did you read that you ought to take the Lomotil and the Mirazine can be used if you do get nauseated, any one of the three of you?
Okay, thank you.
To Borman's surprise, Dr. Chuck Berry came on the line to talk to him directly. That almost never happened. Unknown to Borman, the episode had triggered serious talk of canceling the mission. Berry worried that Borman had a virus and that it was only a matter of time before his crewmates caught it. But Borman told the Earthbound flight surgeon that he felt much better and that neither Lovell nor Anders had been affected. Just a few minutes later, in consultation with Berry and other managers, Apollo Program Director Sam Phillips decided to let the flight continue. Even if Phillips had decided otherwise, Apollo 8 was too far away for a swift about-face maneuver. Borman, Lovell, and Anders were committed now. Even if they had to abort, their mission would at least go around the moon. When Apollo 8 finally reached the halfway point between the moon and the Earth, the crew made their first television broadcast. Here are a few clips from that broadcast.
Houston, we just got it.
You are getting it.
Okay, Apollo 8, we have a good picture.
We're rolling around to a good view of the Earth. And as soon as we get to the good view of the Earth, we'll stop and let you look out the window at the scene we see. Jim Lovell down in the lower equipment bay preparing lunch. And Bill is holding the camera here for us both. Bill's going to take the camera down the lower equipment bay with Jim.
All right. Okay, we're getting a pretty good picture, but if you'd move it a little slower every time you move it around, why it breaks up on the scan. You've got everybody standing on their heads down here.
How's it going? You got it turned upside down? You got the wrong rest mat.
We all have our problems. Good.
Okay, now we're coming up on the view. We really want you to see us, the view of the Earth. And if you'll break for just a minute, Bill's going to put on the large lens. So we'll be right back with you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, that's a real good picture. That's the best one we've had. And how about just going in and leave your pictures inside until we can think some more about what we can do to adjust for that light?
Roger. What are you doing here? Jim is making just dirty. He's making up a bag of chocolate pudding. Continue to come floating by. Bill's coming up from the lower equipment bay. Of course, that the telephoto lens doesn't work, show the lens at the culprit. This lens doesn't seem to be working. I can't understand why we're not dropping this problem with the light transmission to it. Approximately halfway between the moon and the earth. So we've been 31 hours, about 20 minutes into flight. We have about less than 40 hours left to go to the moon. Get a close-up of Jim Lovell. Bill, you can let everybody see that he's already outdistancing us in the beard race. Kevin's got quite a beard going already. Happy birthday, brother.
During the broadcast, Deke Slayton, who rarely came on the air, asked Borman to comment on his health. Borman's space sickness had now made it to the news, so Slayton wanted to take the opportunity to show the world that the crisis had passed. Borman smiled, waved at the camera, and said everyone felt fine. About 14 minutes after the telecast began, it was time to end it. Borman would now set the spacecraft back on its slow thermal control spin barbecue mode, and that meant the high-gain antenna could no longer track the Earth. Before they signed off, Lovell ducked into the picture. He wanted his mother to get a look at him because today was her 73rd birthday. Lovell looked at the camera and grinned and said, "Happy birthday, Mother." At T plus 2 days, 7 hours, 207,000 miles out. The Earth was so far away now that Jim Lovell could hide it behind his outstretched thumb. The feeling this evoked in the pit of his stomach was hard to convey. It was that delicious mix of exhilaration and apprehension that comes from testing yourself in dangerous conditions. When Apollo was first conceived, it was thought that the astronauts would act not only as pilots, but as onboard navigators. But that task proved to be so time-consuming, and it used up so much of the memory of the command module's computer, that planners decided to let the work be done by computers in mission control. Still, there had to be a backup, in case Apollo 8 lost communication with the Earth. In that contingency, Lovell would use the stars to navigate with the command module's 28-power sextant. He could measure the angle between selected stars and the Earth's edge, enter the data into the computer, and let the electronic brain compute Apollo 8's location relative to the Earth and the Moon. He had already tested his skills with practice star sightings, and the results were within a few thousandths of a degree of perfection. Lovell was proud of his role in the first circumlunar voyage. Here's the clip.
Jim, I've just been looking at your marks with respect to accuracy, and they figure they're within a couple thousandths of a degree of the theoretical optimum.
Lovell's proficiency in navigating the spacecraft with its onboard optical instruments would eventually earn him the nickname the Man with the Golden Fingers. His speed was such that he would be requested to slow down so that the Earth-bound machines recording the data could keep up with him. The accuracy of his sightings was virtually flawless, symbolic of the entire mission. a mission so accurate that several of the planned mid-course corrections would be dropped as unnecessary.
A few minutes after the second telecast ended, Borman, Lovell, and Anders passed the most significant milestone since leaving Earth, and yet they were completely unaware until Houston mentioned it. At 38,900 miles above the moon, Apollo 8 reached the top of the gravitational hill and crossed over into the lunar gravitational sphere of influence. At that moment, Apollo 8 was traveling only 2,223 miles per hour. But in mission control, craft's flight controllers saw the craft begin to speed up. But the astronauts felt nothing. They saw no change in the visible universe. Outside, there was the same dull, starless black. To Anders, the lack of tangible milestones made the voyage seem even longer. At one point, Capcom Jerry Carr asked what they could see, and Anders replied, "Nothing. It's like being in the inside of a submarine." The moon itself was nowhere to be seen. Anders had looked forward to watching it grow even larger as they closed in until it became a huge cratered ball in the sky. But he had not seen the moon once on the whole trip out, not even a glimpse. Because of Apollo 8's angle of approach, the moon was lost in the sun's glare. It was really an act of faith for Anders even to convince himself that when the spacecraft arrived, that the moon would really be there. Salutations from the foothills of North Carolina. This is Michael Annis, your host, and I wanted to say thanks for listening to episode 167 of the Space Rocket History Podcast, entitled Apollo 8, Coasting Uphill. Space Rocket History is a proud member of the History Podcasters and the Tech Podcasting Network. I want to give a big shout out to all my longtime listeners. Thanks for staying subscribed, and extend a warm welcome to my new listeners. I'm glad you're here. Today, we salute my Patreon donors. Patreon donors give a small amount monthly to support the podcast, and I wanted to thank each and every one of you donors who honored your pledge this month. Well, what did you think about that waste management system for Apollo 8? A vacuum hose for number one, and a plastic bag for number two. Now that would have been difficult to use, not just for the astronaut using it, but also for his crewmates. Man, that little capsule must have stunk. And to get things started out right, Borman vomits and then has diarrhea. Oh, man, I felt so sorry for Lovell and Anders having to clean up that mess. Oh, my goodness, that was bad. It's good that they can joke about it now. But, boy, at the time, I bet that was a real struggle to get through it. And, of course, Borman got embarrassed about it because he's an astronaut and a veteran space travel. He's not supposed to vomit. It couldn't have been motion sickness. It had to be a 24-hour bug, right? Probably not. He was so embarrassed he didn't even let Anders report the vomiting except on the tape that was delayed 8 hours. Oh, well. Now, I do want to apologize for the quality of that audio for Apollo 8's first TV broadcast. It was the best I could find, so I apologize if you have any trouble hearing that. An amazing thing about Apollo 8 to me was that the astronauts could not see the moon as they coasted toward it. The sun was right behind it, and they could not look directly at the sun without hurting their eyes. So they really took it a lot on faith that they were really going towards the moon, and of course they were assured that by Mission Control in Houston. Now on that translunar coast, I hope I explained it well enough. You see, when Apollo 8 fired its engine for translunar injection, they coasted the rest of the way to the moon. The gravity of the Earth gradually slowed them down until they reached the point that the moon's gravity was stronger than the Earth's, and the moon's gravity sped them up. So it's kind of like coasting up a long hill and then making it over the top. Okay, I posted some pictures for this episode on my website, spacerockethistory.com. Make sure you check it out. We had, over the past 2 weeks, three donations. First is from Bozo J from Croatia, donated at the Apollo level. Thank you very much. Then Colin S. from Pennsylvania, donated at the Vostok level. Thank you. And James M. from Illinois, donated at the Mercury level. Thank you very much. So our Patreon donors remained at 56. Our overall donors are at 126. We did stay on pace with reaching 250 in June because we had 125 donors in June. And so far this month, we've had one donor. So to stay on pace for reaching 250 donors by the end of 2016, we need to have at least 20 more donors by the end of July. So, if you are enjoying the podcast regularly and haven't donated yet this year, please donate to fund the podcast. It doesn't have to be a lot. You can make a one-time Sputnik-level donation for $5, or you can make a minimum donation of 50 cents per month at Patreon. To make a one-time donation, go to the homepage, spacerockethistory.com, and click on the orange donate button on the top right of the page, or you can sign up with Patreon by clicking the Patreon link also on the homepage just below the donate button. Or you can donate by check if you want to. Just send me an email and I'll give you the address. All donors are rewarded with their name on the donors page at the website spacerockethistory.com based on their donation level. To stay up to date on podcasts, including previews of the next week's episode, please follow me on Twitter and Facebook. The links are on the homepage, spacerockethistory.com. I was pleased to see the podcast receive two new 5-star ratings on iTunes this week. Want to thank Carson Timmons and Jeffrey Smith for the 5-star ratings and reviews. I really appreciate it. Want to encourage everyone to share the podcast. Feel free to link the homepage or a particular episode on all social media. And thanks for those who've already done so, like my retweeters: Jet City Star, 1202 Alarm, 1122-1963, Ashley James Lee, Atherin, ATM Int Arch, Bennett Can Tweet, Bird at Home, Bonner to You, Buddy P. Murphy, Cambuntu, David B. Nugent, Drupal Puppies, Duke of Oil 60, Fredevil, Futurama King, Glenn Trudgett, Gretchen Ware, History Dean, History Mile, Jacob Hahn, Kadavi 1202, Keith Bram, Keith Drankwine, KHS Astronomy, Logbook Guy, Matt Milko, Moa the Dinosaur, Plunder 100, Pompeiator, Rapid Mustang, Skibby, Stephen Lebowski, Stiggy, This is Alex Boyd, Tomasino 1202, and To Rule. I really appreciate it. If I missed anyone, let me know and I'll get you next week. This is the end of content for this episode, and I had a few off-topic thoughts. If you're not interested, please feel free to switch to the next podcast. Thanks for sticking around, folks. I hope you enjoyed that episode. Next week, we will continue with Apollo 8 in orbit around the moon. In podcast news, in case you didn't hear, my MacBook failed on me last week, so I uploaded an Encore episode from another computer. Now, this is the same MacBook that I bought last October. The problem was, it went to sleep and wouldn't turn back on. After I spent a bunch of time trying to figure out what's wrong and watching YouTube videos to see what to do to fix it, none of those solutions worked, so I had to take it to the Apple Store, and they said it was a bad logic board, which I had always called them motherboards, but I guess Apple calls them logic board. Anyway, that doesn't matter. Anyway, the logic board had to be replaced, and they couldn't do it here, so they sent it to Austin, Texas to be repaired. And I got it back pretty quickly. They FedExed it back, and it went pretty well. But it was conveniently out of warranty, and I had to pay $300 to get it fixed. When I bought it last year, it was $949. So now I have a total of $1,249 invested in it. I tell you, it's just another unplanned expense of podcasting. And, of course, I can't do the podcast without this computer because it's the one with GarageBand that I use to record the episodes. So I have to have this laptop working. So that's what we went through last week, and that's why you got an Encore episode. In other podcast news, my host, Blueberry, had some trouble with statistics in June. They lost about a day and a half of download statistics. But we still broke the record for episode downloads in June. So we set a new record. Now, obviously, I'm pleased with that. And here are the top 10 countries with the most downloads for June. Number 1, U.S. Number 2, U.K. Number 3, Germany. Number 4, Australia. Number 5, Canada. Number 6, Finland enters the top 10. Number 7, France. Number 8, Netherlands. Number 9, Norway. And number 10, Sweden. In personal news, I am delighted to report that everyone is pretty healthy. My grandson is gaining weight. He's now over 8 pounds, and his hemoglobin level is holding steady, and we're very thankful for that. My wife and I just celebrated our 35th wedding anniversary. We got married on the 4th of July in 1981, 35 years ago. Well, I would think that she deserves an award for putting up with me that long. So thank you very much, sweetie, for putting up with me that long. Okay, that's about all the time I have for this week. I hope to have episode 168 up by next Thursday. So long for now.